And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, where it's time for the second edition of Nobody's Favorite Podcast Gimmick of 2020. So where the hell were we? And to help me refresh our memory on where the hell we were with three of the most interesting teams in the NBA, the one and only, the greatest to ever do it, Mr. John Hollinger. How are you?
Thank you for the far too kind words, and thanks for having me on the show. I'm doing great.
I'm glad to hear it. It has been, sometimes you wake up and you're like, has all this really happened? It's been a while. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this series, because I really do think it's actually a useful exercise, even for me and you who live and breathe this stuff on a daily basis, to go back and be like, wait a second. So what the hell was going on in March in the NBA? So let's start with a team you picked to win the championship, a team I picked to make the finals, the most interesting team in the NBA, the wackiest team in the NBA, the Philadelphia 76ers. Are you ready?
Yeah. Yeah. This is an interesting one.
They somehow traded Markelle Fultz, who forgot how to shoot, and remained the most interesting team in the NBA. That's a hard thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And Jimmy Butler. They lost Jimmy Butler and that whole drama, and still.
Well, that is an interesting segue, because let's review the big picture metrics on the 76ers. 39-26, sixth in the East, although tied with the same record as Indiana. They are currently behind in the tiebreak with Indiana. We will get to that. Right above them in fourth and fifth are Miami and the Pacers. For the season, the Sixers are 18th in offense, which is your glaring red flag that something is wrong here, and sixth in defense. Since the trade deadline, which is a central theme of so where the hell were we, they are first in offense. Whoa, what the hell happened there? And 22nd in defense. Whoa, what the hell happened there? They were in the midst of maybe starting to bring Al Horford off the bench and breaking up the ginormous starting five that had been as advertised on defense and way worse than advertised on offense. An injury to Ben Simmons cut that short, because Brett Brown reinserted Al Horford right back into the starting five when Ben Simmons went out. And here we are. So I will start with a broad question for you. Would you rather remain in sixth and have Boston in the first round, a superior opponent to any of your potential four or five opponents, or move up to although that being said, a team that the Sixers have played well, they've played the Celtics well, or move up into four or five, have an easier first round opponent, but put yourself in Milwaukee's bracket, side of the bracket for the second round?
I think you move up for two reasons. I mean, if you're Philly, you came into this year with the idea that you're contending for the Eastern Conference championship, right? So it's not just a question of, yay, we won a round. It's can you get all the way through it? And to me, putting yourself in a position where you have to beat the top three seeds consecutively is too hard. So if you move yourself up into that 4-5, it's fortuitous for them that even if you get to 5, there's no home court advantage this year. So 4-5 basically doesn't matter. You're going to have to beat Milwaukee at some point anyway. You only have to beat one of Boston or Toronto now, and you give yourself a much better shot of getting out of the first round. I mean, I think even with the issues Philly has had this year, they would be a favorite against either Indiana or Miami in a first round series. So to me, it's not that hard a call that you definitely try to move up.
I was hoping you would say the opposite for some reason, but to me, it's a no-brainer. You get out of the Boston matchup, and I don't care that you've played Boston well. Boston is a really good team, markedly better than the teams below them. You get into 4-5, now, and then you have to play Milwaukee, and like, there's no rhyme or reason to this anymore. We're in totally uncharted territory. Like, we used to have these debates as, is it better to catch the number one seed early? Is it better to wait longer into the playoffs and prolong it so that maybe they catch an injury or something? Now, in this world of a pandemic, there's just, and maybe a higher injury risk right off the bat. I don't know what the right answer is. You could make an argument either way. I completely agree with you that you just need to get out of the sixth seed if you can. And by the way, their very first game in the bubble is against Indiana. Mark it down. That's a big game. If Philadelphia wins that game, they not only jump over Indiana in the standings, they almost certainly win the tiebreaker against Indiana because they even the head-to-head matchup at 2 and they have a better conference record by 3 games if they win that game. So that's a hugely important game. My other big picture Philly question for you was 29-2 at home, 10-24 on the road. Like the 86 Celtics at home and the 2020 Knicks on the road. There is no more home and road. So I ask you an impossible question. Is this better for Philly because they don't have to play any more road games, or worse for Philly because they don't get any more home games?
I mean, are these all road games?
I don't know.
Are these all technically road games?
I don't know.
Just two road teams? I tend to think all of that is just really interesting statistical noise. But I mean, if you're going to count this as one or the other, I think you're more inclined to account this as an extended road trip. So that probably isn't a great omen for Philly. I mean, you know, it's the same thing. You're in a hotel. You're not at your own facility. Everyone's away and kind of forced to pack together and get on the buses to go places and stuff. So to me, the vibe is much more road than home.
I don't know the answer to this question. I lean more to you. Maybe it's because I'm a natural pessimist and I'm always have a bleak outlook on things in general. But to me, they lose. It's more that they're losing the advantages they get at home. They're losing other teams traveling to them, staying in unfamiliar beds, and a crazy rabid home crowd. Although a home crowd, I will say, that was willing and did turn on this team at a moment, like a 6-0 run. Uh-huh. They're ready to start booing these guys. I love that crowd.
So interesting story there. You know, we played them in Fultz's first ever preseason game, and he struggled right out of the bat. And they turned on him by the third quarter. Like, it was amazing. Like, their reputation is not undeserved. Let's put it that way.
Oh, also important Philly home note. The last time you and I saw each other, the second to last time you and I saw each other, was in Los Angeles at a Lakers-Pelicans game. And we did a podcast after that game. Mm-hmm. And we talked about who had the best walk-off song between the LA teams. With the walk-off winning song.
Right, right.
Neglected to mention that the undisputed champion of that is 1-2-3-4-5 Sixers in Philadelphia. That's the best walk. Do you know this song?
I do not, no.
The most literal. It's like a child wrote it. It literally just goes 1-2-3-4-5 Sixers, something, 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 Sixers. But it's hypnotically amazing, and it's the best walk-off song. So I ask you this. Oh, another reason, if Philly moves up to 5th, mm-hmm. likely, not certain, likely we get Jimmy Butler against the Sixers in the first round. I say not certain because Miami has a tough schedule and a front-loaded tough schedule.
And they play Indiana twice. So if Indy wins both games, they're caught up. Miami owns a tiebreak against both these teams. But if they lose both Indiana games, yeah, Miami could easily end up at 6. Because Philly's schedule is easy in this thing. Like, Philly should be able to move up.
Philly's schedule is angel food cake. And it's a no-brainer that they should not be 6. If they care about not being 6, they shouldn't be 6. But we do need Jimmy Butler against Philly in the first round. Should they – now, they brought Al Horford off the bench for 3 games. Mm-hmm. One of those 3 games was a home win against the Clippers, which I think was one of the best games in the NBA all season in terms of level of play, and I think a tentpole game for the Sixers, one that they look at internally as that's the team we kind of envision being. We're proud of that game. Then Ben Simmons got hurt. All of that was cut short. If you're Brett Brown, do you go right back to bringing Al Horford off the bench?
Here's the thing about the Sixers that is interesting to me when I was looking at their stuff. Al Horford's played 2/3 of his minutes this year at center. He's actually mostly played center because between them subbing out early when Horford and Embiid both play, or Embiid not playing and Horford being at the 5, he's actually played mostly at the 5. Now, you're going to have to play some stretches with them two together no matter what, but I guess I'm dodging this a little because to me, the far more interesting question is not whether you start Horford, but whether you finish with Horford.
Sure.
And it just seems to me that the pieces have never totally fit with Horford and Embiid and Simmons. Like, you get a maximum of 2. to really make things work, and that they need more perimeter craft around those three players in terms of shooting and ball handling, whether that's a Shake Milton or an Alec Burks or a Korkmaz or somebody, even though, you know, those guys haven't exactly set the world on fire, just the fit with the overall unit and what they can allow Simmons and Embiid to do is so much better.
It is a little bit of a red herring as a question, because there are going to be a certain number of Embiid plus Horford minutes in your rotation. To your point, the larger issue might be how many of those minutes also come with Simmons on the floor. I do think it's an important question, and I liked the way they looked bringing Horford off the bench. Again, I might just be being swayed by a couple of really good games collectively that they played, a tiny sample. Mm-hmm. But for the season, they're -9 with a horrible offense when Simmons, Embiid, and Horford play together. And to your point, when any two of them play without the other, they're pretty damn good. So, and some of this will obviously be matchup dependent. There will be matchups that are friendlier to those three being on the floor together. I like the idea of, I don't know what they're going to do. I should preface this all, but I don't know what they're going to do. I think had they stayed healthy, they would have leaned all the way into Horford coming off the bench. Once you pull that Band-Aid off, it's off. I like the idea of going back to that. Then the question becomes, you know, who do you start as your fifth guy? You just named some of the candidates. I don't really have a passionate argument for any of them. I think Korkmaz has had kind of a sneaky good year for them, but he introduces a defensive weak link.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, they what's really interesting about them is, even when they look horrible on offense, their best lineups are equivalent to the best defense in the entire league. And in the end, that's how they're going to win. So I don't know what the right answer to this question but I do lean to, can we cut the minutes all those guys play together by 15%? I think that probably helps them.
Yeah. And then the other thing that does, I think, is it allows Tobias Harris to play more minutes at the four too, which is where I think he's better, and where defensively I think it's considerably better. By the way, I mentioned all those players. I left out Matisse Thybul, who obviously would be a candidate there as well.
I don't think he is going to be maybe he would. I believe that he may have started one of the games. I can't remember. Glenn Robinson the third started two of them, maybe.
Yeah.
And the Korkman, I started one. The Korkmaz and Ben Simmons have a sneaky little two-man game going on, mm-hmm. where Korkmaz screens for Ben Simmons and flares out. It's a sneaky little treat.
He's got some stuff to him, and he's still 22. I mean, he's still young. I was a little surprised they didn't pick up his option, and then I was very surprised the league let Philly get away with bringing him back on a two-year minimum. I thought there were rebuilding teams that should have taken a shot at him.
He does have some stuff to him. He has a little, like, one-bounce floater kind of game. He competes defensively. He's been exposed a little bit when they try to put him on point guards who are just too quick for him. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because part of the strength of their defense is not only do they have outstanding top-end defenders in their best lineups, but they put out defenses. They put out a lot of lineups where you have no weak link. The closest thing is Tobias Harris, who I think has made meaningful strides. And as you know from building teams, like, part of having a great defensive team sometimes is not having a weak link. Now, you can have a weak link if your three or four other guys are just outstanding. Like, that's what the Warriors have essentially been. But if you have no weak link, that on its own is really powerful.
Yeah, yeah. And that's where these – I mean, that's what we saw in the Toronto series last year, where it just the floor looks so small for the Raptors in that series, and they had, you know, they ended up pulling it out just because Kawhi was amazing and they were able to, you know, do just well enough against Philly's offense. But I think that's what they're looking at in the playoffs, is can they do that again against a team like Milwaukee, especially,
you know, in that series. Obviously, you know, the other notable thing about that Raptors-Sixers series was that Jimmy Butler really took the offense. It became his offense as a lead ball handler. They made an absolutely monumental decision to not bring him back and mm-hmm. to effectively sign and trade him for Josh Richardson and Al Horford. I get what they were going for. You and I obviously liked their team very much before the season. They started 20-7 and have been 500 in the 38 games since, so it didn't last. I think they anticipated between Richardson, who's a decent secondary ball handler, Harris, who's a decent secondary ball handler, Embiid in the post, and better overall passing with Horford, and importantly, some development of something of a jumper from Simmons.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest one. Yeah.
That they could compensate for the loss of the only thing on their team like a lead ball handler, and it has not happened yet.
Yeah.
I don't fault them for the decision necessarily. I can't do it now because I picked them to make the finals. I still think they have the chance to be a good playoff team. But I do think they'd be better right now with Jimmy Butler. Now, maybe not because of chemistry. That's the other thing. You know, how was his relationship with Brett Brown? How was his relationship with the Stars? But you know from being inside a team, like, those are the decisions that you can't get back, that you lose sleep over for weeks and weeks, because they really define your team. And that one, and Jimmy Butler has been the protagonist in Chicago. Moving off of him was a franchise-defining decision, and this one was pretty close to that.
Yeah, it was interesting because at the end, I thought during the year, because you heard various mutterings during the year that maybe the fit wasn't so great with those guys, and like, you know, pretty shortly after the trade even. But after that series, when he took it over, I thought, okay, they may sit back and reevaluate this and just go ahead and give him the 5 years and take a run at this. So it's a little surprising in light of the fact that once you made those moves to go all in, which they basically did, once they made the Harris trade and the Butler trade, like, they were all in with this team at that point. So to say you're all in and kind of really focused on the now, and then to be unwilling to give Butler that fifth year, it was kind of a little bit of a record scratch, maybe. It was an interesting move, to be sure. Now, they still have cards to play. I mean, they still can make moves with these guys after the season and shuffle the deck again. And keep an Embiid Simmons core and still have other options around it. So that may be what they end up doing. But yeah, was it a franchise defining move? Yeah, I think clearly.
And they do have this pick, this Oklahoma City pick, this top 20 protected pick that is very, it's top 20, right? That's very much
top 20 protected. Yeah. 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 It's a shame they don't play OKC in the last game in the bubble. That would have been amazing to see them tank the game to get a first round pick.
I believe as of now, they are getting it as of now, right?
I think they missed by half a game right now or something, but it's going to get real close here. Yeah. It could come down to the, you know how they do the coin flip with the teams with the same record?
Yes.
This could come down to a coin flip.
They got to televise that because I want to see the quality of the flip. I want to know, does the NBA employee who flips the coin, is he practicing for like a month?
Right.
If he flubs it, what if it hits a table? Is there a table within a 5 foot radius of the flip? I want to tell me what everybody would watch. I know, like, the guy who holds the stopwatch in the lottery, that's a serious job. That guy practices that. Like, that's a real, anyway. So here's, you want to know like where we are in the world, how crazy this all is.
Okay.
You know, better than anyone as a math guy, that Portland in the West has this ridiculous advantage by virtue of having played two extra games.
Yes.
And
1/100th of a point. Yes.
What's cool about
1/1000th of a point.
Sorry. Yeah. Whatever it is, decimal of a decimal. What's cool about Philly, Indiana, Miami is they've all played 65 games going into the bubble. So they're going to all finish with the same number of games. So we don't have to do any of this finagling and monkeying around with winning percentage, all the traditional tiebreakers. So my brain doesn't hurt as much thinking about this as it does in the Western Conference, where I just want to start drinking 10 minutes into the thought process of what the hell is happening there. Have we missed anything on Philly? Are there any statistical indicators that you find very interesting about this team? We have barely even talked about Embiid, who Brett Brown says is in great shape. Simmons presumably is healthy. What have we missed? Is there anything you want to hit?
The only thing I see with this team that's a little interesting is that you expect them to be, I think they were built to be awesome defensively, and they're good, but, you know, they haven't been awesome, right? they've been a good defensive team. And I think the way they were built, I think they thought they would be a phenomenal defensive team. So that's been a disappointment. And can they get to that in a playoff environment?
Agreed. I think they can. And I think their best lineups have that profile already. And although I did not put him on either of my all defensive teams, I think that Joel Embiid, healthy and engaged, is the single biggest defensive force in the NBA and changes games on that end of the floor more than any other human alive. And by the way, interestingly, offensively, although he's, I think, a little overrated on offense, given he's turnover prone and doesn't shoot it as well as you think, with Joel Embiid on the floor, their free throw rate is number one in the NBA.
Oh, that's totally believable. Yeah.
With Joel Embiid off the floor, their free throw rate is number 30 in the NBA.
Wow. He's
the only driver of free points that they have on their team.
Wow.
And I agree with you. Their defense has not been quite as good. They counted on we're a top two to top three defense, and they haven't been that yet, but I do think they can. And I do think that they present at least – nobody gives Giannis trouble anymore, but they at least – they don't have an answer. I don't want to say they have answers. They have better potential answers than almost any team in the NBA.
They have three different guys they could put on him, and it's not laughable, right?
Yes.
When you look at Simmons, Horford, and Embiid, all three of them can potentially be put on Giannis, and you think, okay, we have a chance in that matchup.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part, each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code LOW. That's code LOW, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast. Visit vividseats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes, catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems with nothing on your roof. So who's there up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons. Watch out for them. You name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Let's move to team number two in this week's edition.
All right.
So Where the Hell Were We? By the way, you get no prizes for participating in So Where the Hell Were We? You get nothing. You get nothing and like it. Who used to say that on SportsCenter? You get nothing and like it. That used to be.
That was an Olbermann thing, wasn't it?
Was it Olbermann? God, that was so good. All the young people don't even remember what the Dan Patrick, Keith Olbermann thing. The Miami Heat are 41-24, mm-hmm. Fourth in the East. One of the best surprise stories in the NBA. Seventh in offense for the season. 14th in defense. Since the trade deadline, they're 12th in offense, 14th in defense. They just made, before the season ended, a big-ish trade with your old team, acquiring Andre Iguodala and Jay Crowder to round out their wing rotation.
Why do you hate Solomon Hill?
And Solomon Hill. Solomon Hill, I don't mind. Solomon Hill's an NBA rotation player when he hits threes, which seems to be like the phases of the moon control that or something. I don't know. Which would seem to give Miami more – the more wings they have, the easier it is for them to play Bam Adebayo at center, which I still think is the iteration of their team that's going to count, that they're going to play when it counts. I guess my overarching question for you, and this is a little bit of a leading one, is I think I know the answer. Do you believe that they're as good as their record? And if not, and I assume you don't, how much worse than their record do you think they are?
I don't think they're quite as good as their record. I think that's a tribute to Eric Spoelstra in a way, right? He's done a great job of kind of maximizing this team and a little bit of smoke and mirrors. Very important move that didn't get commented on enough. Having the Stones to start Kendrick Nunn from game one rather than just stick with the veteran Dragic, which I think 98% of NBA coaches just would have done. And that's been hugely productive. They've gotten a ton out of Duncan Robinson. Jimmy Butler, it's interesting. He's been a hugely effective player despite not being able to make a jump shot. Which you don't think is possible in the NBA. Now, you worry a little that, like, he's become so he's like moving into Chris Paul territory with the foul drawing. You know, he's become such a Jedi master of that that you worry a little bit if that's going to translate into the playoffs with smarter defenders and better refs and whatnot. But it's that's been a really effective thing offensively. And then he's really evolved as a passer too, I think, where he's been able to be their lead playmaker a lot, and it's enabled them to play kind of these lineups with a quasi point guard or no point guard at all. And that's really helped them. But, you know, your point is an interesting one though. They start games with Adebayo at the four and Myers Leonard at the five. Their game two adjustment, if they lose game one, is abandoning that, right? As soon as they lose a game in the playoffs, their adjustment the next game will be starting Adebayo at center, and we will never see Myers Leonard again.
I like that. I like that phrase, game two adjustment. Interestingly, this surprised me when I looked it up, because I am with you that, again, when it's nut-cutting time and they have to win in the fourth quarter, Bam Adebayo at center is the way they are going to play and should play, and it's the reason they acquired some extra wings, or one of the sort of offshoot reasons. Their starting lineup is plus 13 per 100 possessions in a lot of minutes. I didn't think they're starting a lot. When I looked it up, I thought it would be like a good lineup. They're a good team. Yeah. I thought it'd be plus five, plus six, plus 13. I was like, wow.
That's amazing.
Now,
because that's almost all first and third quarter minutes against other teams' starting lineups. Because so Leonard does not play the second and fourth quarters, right?
No.
So that's amazing. That shocks me. I did not know that.
I double checked before the podcast because I wanted to make sure. So I have a soft spot for the Heat, hashtag Heat culture. One of the last long trips I took during the season was to Miami to sit down with Bam and his friends for a big Bam profile.
That was a great story, by the way.
Thank you. I love Bam. I think Bam is a stud. I do think there are reasons to be skeptical of Miami's production on both ends of the floor. Not skeptical, like it's all a fluke. Okay, people need to understand it's all a fluke. No. I'm just saying, like, maybe they're 5% worse or 10%. No, 10% is a lot. 5% worse on both ends. Let's start on offense. They are number one in the league in 3-point shooting.
Yeah.
And if you look at the second spectrum tracking data, which measures what you would expect this team to shoot based on the location of each shot and who's taking it and where the defense is, and again, who's specifically taking it, and what they actually shoot, they're number one in the biggest differential, positive differential, overall for all their shots in the NBA. There's also part of me that fears Duncan Robinson is about to get the Kyle Korver treatment in the playoffs, where Kyle Korver every year kind of realizes that what life is like when teams really dial in on all the cute off-ball stuff you do. And to your point about Jimmy Butler, they're number one in the league in free throw rate. And how much does that decline against good defenses in a playoff whistle? Does any of that resonate with you? One of my overarching questions is, can this team really score? Can this team really score at this rate against good defenses?
I still question it, I guess. But, you know, it's interesting with the foul drawing, because one of Philly's weaknesses that we didn't really discuss, they foul a lot. And sometimes with teams foul a lot, you go and look and it's all secondary players who aren't going to be playing. But the Sixers, like, their main players foul a lot. And so that's going to be there, or that could be a way for Miami to get some points against Philadelphia. Like, you know, Joel Embiid, especially, like, Joel Embiid is a high foul rate. Like, that could be a thing if they're able to draw some whistles on him. That said, I sort of share your suspicion. I, like, there's one perimeter ball handler that you're really scared about, right? You know, and then you just have to lock in on Robinson, and kind of you'll live with the rest of it.
I'm gonna give them two, because I think Dragic had a really nice year for them coming off the bench. And when you talk about, I think he's a six-man candidate. And when you talk about what happens if they decrease their Myers, Leonard, Kelly, Olynyk minutes, candidate number one to play more, I think, is Goran Dragic. Candidate number two is Andre Iguodala, who it's like he barely got his feet wet in Miami before the season stopped.
Yeah. Yeah, that's going to be interesting to see how that works. And candidate number three, I would say, would be to play Jay Crowder at four next to Bam.
Andre Iguodala, Jimmy Butler, and Jay Crowder. A trio that, as you just alluded to, could be a part of their closing lineups. Maybe not. Between Duncan Robinson and Kendrick Nunn and Dragic, they have a lot of pieces. Derek
Jones, too.
Derek Jones Jr. is a really nice story. I'm glad you brought him up. Those three guys, Butler, Iguodala, Crowder, only played 26 minutes together before the season. I mean, that's nothing. That's like we've been podcasting for 26 minutes. That's nothing. Is there anything to you about Miami's defense, which is again only about 14th or something in the league? Is there anything that makes you worry on that end?
I actually think they should be able to defend a little better than their ranking. I feel like they ought to be better than 14th, actually. I think they have pretty good individual defenders. Nobody who's really like a glaring kick me sign. I mean, teams will go after Duncan Robinson, but he's actually not terrible defensively. Some of those second unit lineups, when you get Dragic, Harrow, and Olynyk in there, like that's pretty flammable, right? But like the main six or seven guys will be playing in the playoffs. You don't see lineups that teams can really go after. I think Spoelstra's done some interesting stuff with the zones. I think like Derek Jones is really good when they play zone. When they play some of these positionless lineups, point guardless lineups, they can go to zone and be somewhat effective. So I actually think they have some potential to punch above their weight defensively.
I don't disagree. I think they're about what they are defensively. If there's a reason to be skeptical of them, it's that they allow the most threes in the league. And so you think, are they getting a little bit lucky? But then again, you start to think Milwaukee, Toronto, Boston, some of the other elite defenses have clearly figured out ways to allow a lot of threes and survive. And interesting trivia, according to the tracking data, Miami's defenders are the closest to opposing three-point shooters in the whole league. By average distance of between the shooter and the closest defender. Now, it's only like 6 inches, 4 inches, 8 inches, depending on the team, but they're number one and it's not really close. So maybe they've figured something out about that. But I agree with you. They've got a lot of good defensive players. And Duncan Robinson, you said it. People will go at him. When you see that dude in person, his arms are so long. You understand why he's a little better than these other teams think he's going to be, and he's tough as hell.
I mean, he's 6'9" too. Like it's an obstacle. You know, height is a big thing defensively. Like just being tall is really helpful in basketball, as it turns out.
Yeah, it is.
Who knew?
It is. It is really. Can you believe Muggsy Bogues survived in the NBA at five? I think he's 5'3". Is that
5'3"? And he played in an era where it was much more half court, much more physical, much more ISO. It really is unbelievable.
I think more needs to be written about Muggsy. Like, I want to read a book. Like, how the hell did Muggsy Bogues do this? That and Jaromir Jagr playing professional hockey until he was like 50 years old are the two. Like, I don't understand how they're able to do this. Although I guess Vince Carter did the NBA equivalent of that just now. Anything else on the Heat that you find interesting? I like this team. I think they're solid. I'm a little suspicious that they have another gear to hit in the playoffs. I don't know that playing Bam more at center is going to appreciably change their overall team, but maybe I'm underselling them a bit.
I mean, I think they're a pretty serious underdog against either Philadelphia or Boston. Against Indiana, I think you're talking about a more of a fair fight.
Yeah, I think that's what we're sort of talking around here. Like if Oladipo doesn't play, or even if Oladipo plays like he did in the
or if he plays and doesn't make a shot, he did before.
I think with apologies to Indiana, who has some very good players on their team and is a good team, I think you clearly want to play them of all the choices you have before you if you're any of these teams.
If only starting your fitness journey was as easy as starting this podcast. The truth is, all the lift big, get big, and beach body ready in 3 weeks pressure stops most of us from even starting. And starting is what matters most. It's everything. Wherever you're beginning, wherever you want to be, Peloton encourages you to just start. With thousands of classes to get you moving and doing what you can. If that's a 10-minute low impact class, they've got those. And when you're ready, take it up a gear with a 30-minute live DJ ride. Start with Peloton and find instructors that will keep you motivated to stay on your fitness journey. Learn the basics and build from there. Remember, doing something is everything. Get started with a Peloton bike or bike plus rental at onepeloton.com/bike/rentals. Terms apply. For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facility safe and your people safer. Call or click Grainger.com or just stop by.
I saved the best team for last.
Yeah.
We're going to the Western Conference now. The Houston Rockets. 40-24, sixth in the West for the season, second in offense and 15th in defense. People may have forgotten this. They decided just before the suspension of the season that they no longer needed functional NBA centers or anyone taller than 6'7" on their entire team in their rotation. Much to the chagrin of basketball traditionalists who were ready for this thing to fail. I mean, they were ready for it to fail before the first game.
Yeah.
Since the trade deadline, they're fifth in offense, 13th in defense. Or I'm sorry, that's since Capella played. Since the trade deadline, seventh in offense, 11th in defense. Eric Gordon is in shape and healthy. James Harden has lost weight. Jeff Green figured out how to shoot again upon arriving in Houston. Mr. Hollinger.
Mm-hmm.
What did I say? They're sixth in the West. We'll get to that in a second. In terms of matchups, do you believe in the Houston Rockets? And do you want to believe in the Houston? Do you want to believe in the Houston Rockets?
They're fighting a guerrilla war at this point, right? Like they realize like doing the same thing everyone else is doing, they weren't going to win. So they decided to do something different. And that different thing is playing basically Robert Covington and PJ Tucker at five, not having a traditional center, having five guys around the 3-point line, basically open the floor up more for Westbrook and then live with whatever happens at the defensive end. And I think the early signs were really encouraging, right? I mean, they beat the Lakers, they beat Boston twice, but then right before the hiatus, they lost four straight games, including a couple to some bad teams. And I think some of their weaknesses got exposed a little bit. Here's the thing I wonder about with Houston. Are the Lakers the perfect team for them to play and try this against?
I'm glad you brought that up because I can't decide. Like, so they're in this 3-6/7 if you include Dallas logjam.
Yeah.
And I think very clearly you don't want to be seventh, right? You don't want to play the Clippers in the first round.
No.
So I'm thinking, you know, Utah lost Bogdanovich. I think Oklahoma City is kind of just what they are. Like, I don't think anyone's afraid. They're a nice team. They're a good team. I don't think any of these teams are afraid of Oklahoma City. Denver at three, I guess you don't want to play Denver just because of Utah has lost a critical player and what I just said about Oklahoma City. But number one, Houston has destroyed Denver head-to-head for the better part of three seasons now. Number two, I'm almost rooting for that matchup because I want to see Jokic, even the slimmed-down Jokic, against a team with nobody within 5 inches of his height. And I can't decide, does Houston even care about that? And to your point about the Lakers, the biggest team in the league, a team that's made its bones playing big, does Houston care at all about does Houston care at all about their matchups? What do they prefer? I don't know.
Yeah. It's odd to think this, but I think the biggest thing that could hurt Houston in a matchup against the Lakers is that they're awful at transition defense and the Lakers are low key really good at transition offense. And that's where the Lakers could hurt them the most, even though the Lakers are the much bigger team and you'd think Houston would be able to outrun them. But Houston, you know, Harden and Russ especially, I mean, they've always been pretty lazy transition defenders. And I think playing 40 minutes a game in this environment probably won't help that.
I don't know. I think if I'm Houston, I would like to get into the 4-5 matchup, assuming that that's going to be Utah or Oklahoma City waiting for me.
Utah is contractually obligated to be in that 4-5 matchup, right? It just we just don't know who the other team will be.
And they're tired of playing Houston in the playoffs, too. I think I'd rather get out of the Denver matchup, I guess, if I could. But my take on Houston was before the trades, I didn't think they could win the championship or really were a serious contender. After the trades, kind of felt the same way. Didn't get much better. Didn't get much worse. With now months of time to look at it, I kind of still think that. However, I do think of everybody below the LA teams in the West, I think they have the best chance to pull off an upset of one of those teams. I think I would take them to pull that upset before Denver. And Dallas, frankly, might be next on my list now that Bogdanovich is gone in Utah. Mm-hmm. What do you – I'm not saying I'm picking them. I'm saying – I think they have the best chance to be the interloper in the Western Conference Finals. But
they're a high variance team, right? Like they have a wide array of outcomes, I think, in most people's minds. If they lost in the first round, would anyone be surprised? No.
No.
If they made it to the conference finals, would anyone be surprised? Probably not really. So I'd put them kind of in that Boston-Toronto tier in terms of at the highest, who has the chance to be playing in conference finals or later. I think they have a chance to be doing that. Whereas some of these other teams that they share a similar record with in the West probably don't as much.
And interestingly, the bigger teams that they've faced haven't really hurt them with post-ups, which is what everybody was focusing on. And Jokic, I think, could, because he's that polished as a post player and as a passer. But where they have hurt them is offensive rebounding. Mm-hmm. And Houston is last in defensive rebounding since they let Capella, since they stopped playing Capella. And they knew that. That was part of their, they knew they were going to struggle. Part of their calculus was, well, if you go for offensive rebounds against us and you don't get them, we're going to run and shoot threes and rain fire on you from above. And the other thing is, they're second or third in forcing turnovers since playing without a center. So all of this is baked into the construction of their team. You know, and their best lineup is going to be Russ, Harden, Gordon, Tucker, Covington. That group has barely played 45 minutes. The starting lineup with House has been plus 10 per 100 possessions. Basically, whenever Harden, Westbrook, Covington, and Tucker have been on the floor together, and you need Covington and Tucker because you need their collective length and defense. The Rockets have been very, very good, like plus nine or plus 10. You throw Gordon in, if he starts making shots again, that is a really dangerous lineup. You still have House, Rivers. Then it gets a little dicey because you're into the Jeff Green, Ben McLemore, do I trust these guys territory?
Well, I mean, with Green, Damari Carroll, Tyson Chandler, Austin Rivers. I mean, like, if you need to win a playoff game in 2014, the Rockets are covered.
Wow.
Like, they got it. Put those guys around Westbrook. Man, you got yourself a squad.
That's right. I do worry that they're I worry that they're one wing short of being able to play this way, which is a facile thing to say because no one has ever tried to really play this way before. And of course you need all you need on your team is wings. So by definition, if you hadn't been really planning to play this way, you're probably going to be a wing short. I don't know that Damari Carroll or Luke Baumute, who they just signed, is going to be the answer, but I didn't mind the decision they made to mothball centers. Didn't bother me. I'm not a traditionalist. I think it makes sense. And I think this is if they can stay healthy, obviously, and if playing super small doesn't physically destroy Tucker and Covington, I just think I'm not picking them to make the conference finals by any means. I'm picking LA. I think they have more of a puncher's chance than the other teams, and I realize Denver fans are not going to be happy hearing that because they're third and they're a damn good team. I like I like the perimeter star power that the Rockets have.
I agree with that. We need to talk about Eric Gordon a little, because he had that 50-point game against Utah, and then he went right back to being really bad in all the games before the hiatus. And that's something, if he isn't effective, I think that really takes some of the juice out of how they want to play, and lowers their ceiling pretty substantially.
He's had the weirdest season and a half or whatever among all sort of semi high profile players in the NBA. I just, every time he shoots, I still think it's going in. And then it's like he's shooting 29% or 31%
from
three.
Yeah. So there is something to that, though, because teams, like players, will still run out at him because he's Eric Gordon. Even like Kyle Korver, teams will guard him a certain way, even if he misses his next 50 attempts, right? So that's, he still has the same spacing effect. It's one of the oddities of your reputation almost counts more than your actual results at a certain level.
I also wonder there if they have, like, they have not really played Covington at center. So like, who's playing center when PJ Tucker rests is a big question for their team. And PJ Tucker don't rest much. That guy plays a lot. Jeff Green was the answer for the most part before the shutdown. Cephalosha, who just opted out, was the answer some there. I wonder if they might even get smaller and try Covington at the five with just a bunch of shooting around him.
I could definitely see them trying it against units with backup centers. If teams are just going to play a regular backup center, or if you're trying to sort of bait the other team into also going small, so your disadvantage isn't as bad. I could see Luke Bamute playing that five role as well, if he's healthy, which I think is a big, I mean, that was a big question mark, right? Like, he had issues with his knee with him when the Clippers signed him. So it's going to be interesting to see what kind of shape he's in.
But, you know, and again, you know, the centerless thing is so interesting because in a lot of ways, it's like, it's the natural evolution of their team, right? So 3 years ago, Harden, Capella, pick and roll. That's the bread and butter. Harden discovers the step back three, doesn't need Capella anymore, doesn't need anybody to set picks for him anymore. They trade Chris Paul, a great shooter, for Russell Westbrook, a horrible shooter. Suddenly they have two bad shooters on the floor in Capella, who's total non-shooter, and Westbrook, and spacing gets a little dicey. Well, let's just dump Capella because we don't use him as a screen setter anymore. It's a very natural, I don't think planned, but
yeah.
Looking backward, you can kind of see how you get from point A to point B. I just think they're really interesting, and I'm rooting for them. I'm rooting for them to find the best version of themselves, because I like interesting stuff, and they're interesting.
Yeah. Another guy we didn't talk about at the five, Bruno.
Oh, I had a feeling we weren't getting through this podcast without Bruno coming up.
Yeah. I think the five is his best position, and he'll pop and shoot the three. And I think that's how they want to play. Can he do that without getting exposed defensively and making mistakes at that end? That's the question mark.
No, the answer is no. However, if we get a Bruno game, because you know, when the playoffs, you get like a Corey Brewer game.
Yeah. An Ersan Ilyasova game. Yeah. Stuff like that happens.
Nick Young game. Mm-hmm. You lived through a Nick. Were you there for the Nick Young game? Clippers?
No. That was the year before I got there, I think, that happened. Yeah. Yeah. Thankfully, I did not have to live through that. That would have been a rough one to take, that whole series, actually.
If we get a Bruno game,
mm-hmm.
It's not going to make any of this worth it, really, but it'll be a nice, we deserve a Bruno game. We really do. Footnote, by the way, Houston's first game in the bubble is against the Mavericks. Yeah, that's a big game because Dallas has ambitions of getting out of seven. Their season series is 1-1, and this is the only time they play. So the tiebreaker is on the line for the Rockets in that game.
Is a tiebreaker going to matter? Is it Houston? Dallas is on an odd number of games, I thought.
You know what? Maybe not. This is too much for me, John.
There's a lot going on with half games here.
Percentage points.
Percentage points. Yeah.
All right. So maybe it's not a big, it's a big game just in the sense that you don't want to be seventh. It's a very, there's a very clear dividing line of where you would prefer not to be in the West. And that's the first game that they play. And hats off to Russell Westbrook, by the way. Since January 1st, 32 points, 8 rebounds, 7 assists on 55% shooting on twos has been an absolute destroyer since they cleared the lane. And those Westbrook non-Harden minutes, which were such a disaster to start the season, have been very good for Houston since around Christmas. So he's done what they have asked of him. And I don't know. We'll see. They're an interesting team. Any Houston things we didn't get?
I'm not sure I have anything. I mean, I think we just have to wait and see how this all, we didn't have that many games to look at post trade and they were still figuring it out. And I think teams were still figuring out their response to them. Now, the one thing with Houston that I think is interesting, the point somebody made to me is the novelty of facing that during the regular season goes away when you play against it in a 7-game series. So will teams by game 2, game 3, game 4 kind of figure out how to play against the centerless operation, figure out how to attack it, and suddenly we see advantages materialize that we maybe didn't see during this short number of games in the regular season?
And to your point, you know, maybe some teams decide to go small right along with them. And Houston's big bet is if you do that, you're probably taking out one of your 4 or 5 best players for someone who is worse than that player, and we win in that talent equation. And maybe that's true and maybe it isn't. Oh boy, they are unfailingly interesting. Before I let you go, the 10-year anniversary of the decision is coming up. Ryan Windhorst wrote a great story about the decision. We will have more Heat-related decision content. What is your memory of the decision? Where were you? What were you doing? What was your reaction? What's your favorite decision story?
So right after they get these guys, they do the 5-year deal with Mike Miller, which obviously Mike Miller helped them win a championship. No argument there. But they lock in 35-year-old Zydrunas Ilgauskas, 37-year-old Juwan Howard, 35-year-old Eric Dampier, 32-year-old Jamal McGlure. They went all in on these older guys when they already had a kind of a deficit of youth on their team to begin with. And so around these three guys in their prime, the one young guy they had was Chalmers. And then they just didn't have anything else. So that first year it showed, and I think even the next couple of years, it really hurt them until they were able to get some younger guys into that system. I thought that was one of the key errors that first season. And it even hurt them all the way at the end. You know, you go back and look in that finals. I mean, they were starting Mike Bibby at point guard.
Against Dallas.
And I mean, asking him to guard some pretty small, fast players. And that didn't work out at all. I think he got DMP'd by the final game, if I remember right. You know, they had a 32-year-old Eddie House there. Like, it was just they put such an old team around those guys, and I think that was a real mistake.
It is interesting to think about what the Heat gave up to. I mean, whatever you need to give up to get LeBron James and Chris Bosh,
you do it. Yeah,
but they gave up 4 first-round picks in sign and trades, including a pick that they had owned from the Raptors that they gave back to the Raptors for Bosh. And then, you know, they all took pay cuts to fit Mike Miller and Udonis Haslam. And although, as you said, Mike Miller had some big moments for them, including in the Oklahoma City finals, I think in their aggregate, he did not bring nearly the production that they expected him to bring over the seasons he was there, nor did Haslam. Or maybe Haslam did. They knew he was going to be a bit player / locker room presence. I just think bang for the buck, they didn't get what they thought they were going to get out of those guys, which left them scrambling. And luckily for them, the scrambling in part led them to Shane Battier and Ray Allen, and they did get bang for the buck from those guys. Those guys ended up giving them the production I think they thought they were going to get from Mike Miller.
Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, they amnestied Mike Miller, and he signed with us for a minimum. So it worked out for everybody.
And pissed LeBron off by amnestying Mike Miller. It was a hell of a 4 years. It was a brief 4-year run, but you know, boy, that was an earthquake when the decision hit. That was an absolute sports news earthquake, the likes of which we haven't seen. I mean, even LeBron going back to Cleveland wasn't the same.
Yeah. Or Durant, or, I mean, to have it with, I think to have it with the three guys at once was such a, what's the word I'm looking for? It was so mind blowing. Cause I think also people's default was that, well, he'll probably end up going back to Cleveland. He's from Ohio, he'll probably go back to Cleveland. So it was shocking.
It was indeed. It was a lot of fun. All right, Mr. Hollinger, thank you for playing. So Where the Hell Were Me? Were we? We've now done seven teams on So Where the Hell Were We? There are 22 total. So my basic math says I have 15 left to do. I'm not sure I'm going to get to all 15. I don't think all 22 deserve a So Where the Hell Were We?
You're not going to do a show on Phoenix, Washington, and Brooklyn?
I don't think so. I don't think we're going to get to those teams. I don't know how many teams we're going to get to, but I don't think we're going to get to all of them. Mr. Hollinger, your work is superlative as always for theathletic.com. You are also on a podcast with fellow nerd Nate Duncan. It's always been a pleasure reading you. It's a pleasure talking to you. I hope I get to see you at an NBA game before like 2022. I don't know that will happen, but I hope I do.
Yeah. Well, I hope so too, my friend. You know, speaking of where the hell were we? I mean, we were both in the Utah locker room after that game in Boston. Was it almost 4 months ago? And I can't remember where you were, but Mike Conley comes up to me and asks, like, are we going to be playing games without fans? Like, what's going to happen? And we're like, we don't know.
It's been a wild 4 months. And just stay healthy, stay safe, and I'll see you down the line.
All right, Zach. Thank you.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.